this was a very nice part, very interesting, and heart-touching. I hope you enjoyed this program. This program was coming to you from Iran, IRIB English Radio. The program is Bookshelf, and the book that we introduced in this episode was Prayers, Worship, and Education. This is Muhammad Javad, signing off.
The Limelight.
Americans continue to be deeply concerned about the pandemic. According to a recent ABC News Washington Post poll, only 11% of respondents said that the virus outbreak was completely or mostly under control, while 88% said it was only somewhat or not at all under control at this time. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Reaches Grim Milestone of 400K COVID Deaths. Here's the details of this article. The United States passed yet another grim milestone on Tuesday, January 19th, as it recorded more than 400,000 deaths due to coronavirus since the start of the pandemic. According to numbers tallied by NBC News, more than 400,103 deaths were attributed to COVID-19 as of early Tuesday, January 19th. Additionally, more than 24 million Americans have tested positive for COVID since the crisis began in the United States. It's been close to a full year since the first case of coronavirus was identified in the United States, which happened on January 21st, 2020. The first confirmed death from coronavirus happened a little more than a month later, in late February 2020. Americans continue to be deeply concerned about the pandemic. According to a recent ABC News Washington Post poll, only 11% of respondents said that the virus outbreak was completely or mostly under control, while 88% said it was only somewhat or not at all under control at this time. Many Americans, the poll also found, say that leadership, specifically from President Donald Trump, has been lacking. Only 38% of Americans approve of how Trump has handled the coronavirus pandemic, a number that ties with his lowest approval rating since the ABC News Washington Post poll started asking the question back in March. 59% of Americans disapprove of how he's handled the pandemic. From the start and through the end of his presidency, Trump has consistently downplayed the threat of coronavirus to the general public. In February, for example, rather than taking the possibility of a pandemic seriously, he described fears about coronavirus as a new hoax being driven against him by Democrats and the media in order to make him look bad. Also in late February, Trump went against the views of several health experts and suggested that the number of cases that had been identified would diminish rather than grow in the coming days. When you have 15 people and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero, that's a pretty good job we've done, Trump said on February 27th, giving himself kudos for how he had handled things up to that point. Of course, that's not what happened. The virus continued to spread at an alarming pace. Comments the president made to veteran journalist Bob Woodward seemed to suggest he knew that was going to happen. In recordings of interviews between Woodward and Trump that the former released this past summer, Trump said he purposely downplayed the threat the virus posed to the country and admitted that it would be deadlier than the flu, contradicting statements he had made to the press and on Twitter. "I wanted to always play down," Trump told Woodward in an interview recorded in mid-March. "I still like playing it down because I don't want to create a panic." Concern about a panic likely wasn't the only thing on Trump's mind. However, as he also indicated that his comments about the virus centered on his political future, and his reluctance to take the pandemic seriously appeared to be tied to his concerns about his re-election. Within a week of the White House's 15 Days to Slow the Spread campaign, which began on March 16th, Trump had already indicated he wanted to take a different direction, tweeting in all capital letters, "We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself." 2 days after that, Trump blamed the media for trying to keep the economy closed in order to hurt him politically. "The lamestream media is the dominant force in trying to get me to keep our country closed as long as possible in the hope that it will be detrimental to my election success," Trump said in a tweet on March 25th. Trump has also discouraged Americans from taking steps recommended by public health experts to limit the spread of COVID-19. In a Wall Street Journal interview in June, the president expressed view that wearing masks was a personal affront to him, worn by those who opposed his presidency out of spite toward him. Trump also regularly expressed doubts about the efficacy of masks in that interview and beyond. "People put their finger on the mask and they take them off, and then they start touching their eyes and touching their nose and their mouth. And then they don't know how they caught it," Trump said. A significant body of research has shown that masks do indeed work to stop the spread of coronavirus. Not only are they beneficial to everyone around the mask wearer, they are also helpful in stopping the spread of the virus to those who are wearing masks. In spite of the evidence showing masks are effective, Trump rarely wears them in public and has hosted several campaign rallies and events at the White House where his supporters could be seen, oftentimes packed in tight spaces without face masks. These events likely had dire consequences. According to one study, 18 campaign rallies that Trump hosted were responsible for the coronavirus-linked death of at least 700 individuals. The failure of the Trump administration to properly control the spread of coronavirus will have far-reaching consequences, even as Joe Biden is set to take over as president. Even with consideration for a fast rollout of vaccines over the next couple of months, a health model from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington shows that another 166,000 Americans are predicted to die from COVID-19 by May 1st of this year. That number could be reduced by more than 30,000 deaths, however, if masks were worn universally.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
And we have not sent you, but as a mercy to the world.
I want to be a servant of God like Muhammad.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Muhammad, Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Like Muhammad. I am Javed Akbari and we are going to talk about Allama Tabatabai's Sunan al-Nabi. This is, of course, a book written by Allama Tabatabai, who is one of the great scholars. And Sunan al-Nabi is about the narrations of the Prophet and conducts and customs of the noble Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. According to the Prophet's recommendation and the Prophet's teachings, when we start reciting the Holy Quran, we must begin reciting it by saying, A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. This is what the Holy Prophet says, فَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ فَاسْتَعِذْ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. When reciting the Holy Quran, one should be considerate and reverent. That it's important to handle, of course, the Quran, as I said, with respect. Of course, when you are about to start reading the Quran, it's recommended to say, A'udhu billah min ash-shaytanir rajim. This is what, in technical terms, it is called ta'awudh, okay? Or isti'adha. Means A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. And this may be interpreted as such. So when you want to recite the Holy Quran, seek refuge with Allah from shaitan, okay? Shaitan, the outcast, the accursed being. This is the literal translation of A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. And then it's also said that after A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim, we should start doing tasmiyah. Tasmiyah, what does tasmiyah mean? Tasmiyah means Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Technical term, tasmiyah means to say God's name, okay, to mention God's name. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Or in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And these are some of the adab and some of the manners of the Quran. And of course, it's important that apart from ta'awudh, apart from tasmiyah, it is important that one sit in a quiet corner away from all kinds of distractions and avoid talking to anybody, because one should not converse about the worldly matters while reading the sacred book of God according to the Prophet's teachings. And if we engage in worldly talks, we are very much likely to get influenced by satanic influence or satanic temptation. The Holy Quran says, وَإِذَا قُرِيَ الْقُرْآنَ فَاسْتَمِعُوا لَهُ وَأَنْسِتُوا لَعَلَّكُمْ تُرْحَمُونَ. So this is a verse from the Holy Quran which clearly states that when you are reciting the Holy Quran, or when the Quran is being recited, you have to listen to it carefully and you have to be silent, okay? And silence means you are giving respect to someone, to the recitation of the Holy Quran, and you are listening to it. It is important to listen, because the Quran is not only for recitation, it's also important for listening. Listening and reciting, and ultimately understanding the Quran. And of course, there are other recommendations from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It is recommended for the reciter of the Holy Quran to brush his teeth with a toothstick or with a toothbrush. And of course, in modern time, we use the toothbrush. But in the past time, they used the miswak, which was a special stick, and they used it to brush their teeth. Now, the aim of the using the toothbrush is to remove food particles from the teeth and to freshen your mouth, okay, before reciting the whole Quran. And this also constitutes respect. This is also one of the adab, one of the etiquette of reciting the Holy Quran.
You are my one true love, taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Mustafa ala
It's also important to choose a pure and clean place. The place where you recite the Holy Quran, it should be a clean place, a pure place. And preferably, the best place is, of course, masjid. Masjid is the place where you should recite, and where reciting the Holy Quran earns you with more reward. And not only the place where you recite the Quran should be pure, but also your clothes should be pure. It is important to wear new and clean clothes. And it's also important to make sure that your hands are not dirty. These are something very important. And let's move on to another narration from Ummi Salama, who said that the Holy Prophet would pause at each ayah he recited. That is to say, he recited the verses articulately, separating between verses, making sure he did not join one verse with another. Okay? And this report from Ummi Salama actually alludes to one thing. We should not rush while reciting the Quran. Tartil is an art. It is a skill associated with the recitation of the Quran. Tartil means to recite the Quran in proper order and with no haste. Now, this word is used in chapter 73 of Surah Al-Muzammil, verse 4. وَرَتِّلِ الْقُرْآنَ تَرْتِيلًا. The verse says that we should recite the Quran in slow, measured, rhythmic tones, and we should not make haste. We need to understand the Quran and contemplate over the verses. And this is what we understand from the report given by Ummi Salama, that the Holy Prophet would pause at each ayah. The Prophet did not join one verse with the other. He did not make haste while reciting the Holy Quran. He recited the verses of the Holy Quran in slow, measured, rhythmic tones. And according to the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, 1 hour of your contemplation is better than 70 years of worship. Now, this is also a saying from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. He says that the Quran is not only to recite the verses quickly, one after another. We should be able to understand the Quran, because if you do not understand the Quran, then you will not receive that guidance. You will not be guided properly. And it is, that's why it is emphasized and it is highly recommended that one should stop and read the verses one by one, one after another, so that he can contemplate and he can understand those verses. Intellection and contemplation are so much vital, which is why the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, said, contemplating for 1 hour is better than 70 years of worship. Tafakkur sa'a khayrun min ibadati sab'ina sana. This saying of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, actually alludes to one thing, that we need to contemplate on the verses and we need to understand the verses of the Holy Quran. And of course, as I said, reciting the Quran is good and it earns you reward. Of course, sawab is there. Even if you do not understand the Quran, it is very important to note that the sawab, you will achieve the sawab even if you do not understand the verses. And there are many people out there who recite the Quran but they do not understand. And inshallah, I will cover this topic in the following episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, ya Rasulullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Today.
The key to stability in West Asia has very different definitions than American and Persian dictionaries. Iran says stability can be maintained only by regional unity and secured by regional powers. The U.S. appears to see stability in omitting regional powers and sowing discord among neighbors. There's over 11,500 kilometers between the U.S. and Iran. Welcome to Iran Today. I'm Leila Faramarzi, bringing you the topic of stability and instability in the region of West Asia or the Middle East. To put it in U.S. terms, instability is synonymous with Iranian policy in the region. Now, how can that be, given two things? One, the fact that the region is Iran's own neighborhood, and two, recent events unfolding in America show anything but stability in the U.S. itself.
We're talking bearskins and horns in the capital as pro-Trump protesters attacked to overturn election results.
Let's hear what Mr. Parkayin has to say. He's our former ambassador and foreign ministry veteran.
Americans are now facing serious instability in their own country, but at the same time they did not leave our region. This is because the U.S. has managed to remain a superpower throughout its history due to its presence in the Middle East and West Asia. today, this active presence no longer exists, which is why Western experts themselves consider the absence of the United States in the region as a sign of its decline.
I've brought you to Parliament today for a quick chat with MPs on the topic of stability in the region, its defenders and destroyers.
The U.S. has a specific formula depending on the situation in every country to secure a foothold there, behaviors that are known by the whole world. Everyone knows that U.S. behaviors in a specific way in the Middle East, South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia, for example. You can see this country's behavior in the world. It is usually pursuing its own interests under the pretext of creating security in the world. That is, the cover of America's behavior is such that it portrays itself as a defender of the nations, but uses the excuse to safeguard its interests and exploit those nations behind the scenes. Iran is a vast country with a unique and ancient history. We have always been a pacifist.
I've heard advocates of U.S. foreign policy say things like, America dropped the bomb to put a stop to the war, referring to America nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II, as if to say the bomb was meant for peace. It gives me confidence in my understanding that to the U.S., it's instability for stability, whereas Iran has been calling for peace and friendship for stability and safety.
They themselves destabilized the region. As is written in history, they started disintegrating Islamic countries. Their presence in the region is in an attempt to disintegrate great Islamic countries, including Iran, Turkey, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, although some Arab countries are not mindful of this issue. They plan to disintegrate these countries to make them unable to defend themselves. They want to appear under the pretext of restoring security in the region and defending the regional nations, and at the same time plunder their wealth and resources.
Perhaps stability and security meant something else to the U.S. in its heyday of imperialism, when smaller countries were more cooperative. But today it means securing the stability of U.S. interests at any cost for others.
و سوریه و لبنان نیستیم، فقط هم ایران نیست. مسئله اصلی لزوم یا عدم لزوم بی‌ثباتی در این کشورها نیست. یعنی بی‌ثباتی مسلمه که باید بی‌ثباتی در این کشورها به وجود بیاد، بلکه چگونگی ایجاد بی‌ثباتی مورد نظر. بی‌ثباتی رو چجوری ایجاد؟ حالا یه وقت در یه جا با داعش، یه وقت با فتنه 88 و با امثال اینها و کارهایی که شما میبینید در منطقه دارن انجام میدن.
جیمی کارتر، the US president that lost Iran, although he did acknowledge later that Iran was never his to be lost, did lord this country as an island of stability. That was in 1977. Between 1972 and 77, the Shah or Iranian king splashed out on a defense build-up with petrodollars. The price of oil quadrupled in 1973, and he purchased more than $16 billion in arms from the U.S. in 5 years, on top of about $3 billion per year in bilateral civilian trade. As soon as 1979, events took a sharp turn. The Islamic Revolution happened, and as 2,500 years of monarchy were toppled, America's island of stability turned into an island of nightmares. It's not what the U.S. and other world powers expected, but it happened. Iranians had decided being an island of stability was no compliment if the country couldn't decide its own fate without foreign interference.
Oil was nationalized before the revolution. If the nation had waited a little, would things have changed, or would Iran carry on with its dependence on the West?
تحولاتی هم خب انجام شد، مثل بحث همین نهضت
Developments took place such as a national oil movement during the time of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani, and a lot of effort was made and the people supported it. But then, when the Americans came back to power and brought back the Shah, they ousted Mossadegh, and in fact, the oil nationalization movement failed. Following that, not only did we remain dependent on the United States, but the Zionist regime also took oil from Iran. The war machine of the Zionist regime was working with Iranian oil. So was South Africa's. That is, the South African war machine against the blacks was also powered by Iranian oil.
A main revolutionary motto of the Iranians was independence. Why did they even feel a vacuum of independence, I asked.
Well, a lack of independence was very tangible before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The reason being that Reza Shah, Mohammad Reza's father, was brought to power by the British. There is no doubt about it. During the reign of Reza Shah, the whole country depended on three great powers, the British, the French, and the Russian, which divided the country into the north and the south. Russia led Iran's oil in the north, while southern oil was controlled by Britain. France was also taking advantage of Iran.
Having suffered 8 years of an imposed war in isolation, referring to the Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s, Iran has built up its defense industry. U.S. interference and involvement it deems a no-no, an outlook that outgoing U.S. President Trump has justified by making it a habit to go back on deals, namely the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal.
The reports from the US or European forums are mainly focused on our missiles. They always speak about our missiles, and they think that our defense power is limited to our missiles. Now, missiles is only one sector of our defense programs. We're as active in other sectors as we are in the missile sector. For example, ground defense, maritime defense, and underground defense. We're also working on other systems. We see how the world is watching us. But we never neglect our defense capability.
Not to go off on a tangent, U.S. interference, even presence, has been a military presence and intervention. To balance power in the region, America has not settled for having its own boots on the ground even, but has created proxies. Its proxies are not your average militia. Rather, America has admittedly created or supported the most savage terror groups operating in the name of Islam. Yet it fights them, selectively. I say selectively because it, the U.S., has acted vengefully against Iran, Syria, and Iraq since their successful fight against Daesh, or ISIS. Just before the General Soleimani assassination last year, Iran's leader accused the U.S. of creating Daesh and saying, the U.S. actions in Syria and Iraq were intended to take revenge on the PMU for defeating ISIS, or Daesh. PMU stands for Popular Mobilization Units, an Iraqi state-sponsored umbrella organization. Now, why does the U.S. see Iran a front to its foreign policy?
After all, Americans have always sought to impose themselves on nations and governments through bullying, to pass themselves off as a superpower. The Islamic Revolution has emerged with the slogan of freedom of all nations of the world, but they don't want this slogan to spread. 4 decades after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we have been able to awaken many of the world's nations with our slogans of seeking justice and freedom. With our own cultural revolution, America doesn't want the awakenings in the oppressed nations.
U.S. propaganda is riddled with controversy. In spite of its sporadic admissions to the contrary, the United States still ostensibly claims it is seeking stability in the world. It claims it is Iran and allies that are seeking terrorism and reducing stability. But history reflects the truth like a mirror. Iran has a no-first-strike policy. It has waged no wars in over 200 years. That's about as long as the U.S.'s whole lifespan, nearly all of which has been spent on war. And now it looks on the verge of a second civil war.
When we review the U.S. culture over the last 200 to 300 years, We see that wherever the US has stepped in South America, in Vietnam, in Africa, there's been war, bloodletting, massacre, and violation of human rights. That has caused insecurity. Therefore, I know no positive example of the US presence in the world to have brought security.
It's understandable. While the traveler will muddy waters to catch his fish, residents would opt for protecting their waters for sanitation and sustainable use. Even with selfish intentions, Iran's interests lie in lack of instability in the region. To establish and maintain all-round relations, especially trade relations with neighboring states, Iran needs the region secure, and it has done something about it, or in some cases made recommendations for sustainable stability and security in West Asia or the Middle East. Iran has constantly been in the spotlight for its considerable influence in the five states, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen. And also, the Palestinian issue is of great consequence to Iran, both geostrategically and for humanitarian reasons. Before getting into each of our five states separately, I'd like to invite you to a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. Here's how the topic of terror and instability, stability versus instability, looks in other outlets. Beginning with China Daily. U.S. duplicity on terrorism, condemnable. Terrorism is the common enemy of all humans, and terrorists have caused great harm to all countries and people around the world. So all countries should treat terrorism and terrorists as potent threats. However, Washington often reacts fiercely to terrorist attacks in the U.S. or its ally countries and stands united with them. Yet when terrorists launch attacks in countries which the U.S. sees as rivals or competitors, it remains indifferent and even tries to use so-called ethnic and or religious problems in these countries to dilute the issue or give it a political twist. Therefore, it is time for the U.S. to abandon double standards on terrorism and stop supporting its favored terror groups. Otherwise, it would also get burned by the fire it has been fanning. We've something from Tehran Times quoting an Indian professor, Ashok Swain, who says the U.S. role in the Middle East or West Asia has never been constructive. Swain, a professor of peace and conflict research at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research from Uppsala University, believes Washington has been seeking its own interests in the region. Its interest has never been for the Middle East's security and development, but for its own security and development. The Indian professor says it will not only be difficult, but in many cases impossible for the Biden administration to bring back the mask of a fair adjudicator, which the USA has been wearing for decades. Fars News quotes Iran's top security official, who underlines the necessity of a U.S. pullout from the region. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, Ali Shamkhani, stressed that the withdrawal of American forces from the regional states is a necessity. The U.S. has intensified its measures to foment insecurity in West Asia in the past year, and the climax of this behavior was the cowardly assassination of anti-terrorism commanders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Shamkhani continued, the Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to take a harsh revenge on the masterminds and perpetrators of this historical crime to stop the U.S. and its agents' continued terrorist and anti-security actions, which stir tension in the region and force them to leave the region. And that's what was on offer from other media outlets. Stay with me, for there's more to come. Iran's interest in creating stability in the region. To demonstrate that by example, let's take a look at Iran's stance towards each of five states. In Iraq, Iran seeks stability because it has common economic, security, religious, cultural, and other interests in this country. The U.S. presence in Iraq has killed hundreds of thousands of people so far. And so, in Iran's view, a U.S. presence will not bring peace here on out either. A warring U.S. presence in Iraq began in 2003. And if terror can be separated from invading a country, given the U.S. is at war in the Middle East at large, but says it's fighting its pet terror groups here, why did it assassinate General Soleimani? Soleimani was Iran's frontman against Daesh. Following the Daesh or ISIS surge into northern Iraq over 5 years ago, Iran moved swiftly by arming Iraqi Kurdish fighters and supporting Baghdad with military advisors. It also provided training for Shia militias in a counteroffensive against Daesh. By fighting the relentless terror group, it kept them off European borders even. Had it not been for Iran's confrontation with Daesh, that bloodthirsty group would probably have taken over Baghdad, and its supporters, the United States and Saudi Arabia, would have just continued to hesitate in confronting it.
What the Islamic Republic of Iran wants is to establish security in the Gulf of Oman, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Persian Gulf. Insecurity will benefit nobody. Naturally, we would never like our neighbor's home to be set on fire, because even if the fire does not spread, the smoke will reach us. That's why we prefer the region to be secure and calm. However, hegemonic nations prefer to create insecurity in the region.
Similarly, in Syria, Iran seeks peace and security, partly by joining the fight against ruthless terrorist groups. Iran's stance is to stand by the Syrian people, the Aleppo liberation, and establishing a truce as key to establishing peace and stability in Syria.
Iran maintains influence in the region because it makes its own decisions and chooses its own friends. There are two types of influence, legitimate and illegitimate. Legitimate influence is when a country, one of Iran's neighbors or a more distant one, invites us to help it counter terrorism. For example, Syria and Iraq invited us. We do not intend to impose our views on these countries and interfere in the internal affairs of these countries. But because they wanted us to help them and because we have a common security risk, we go ahead and help them as an advisor.
As for Palestine, Iran seeks a peaceful solution to the Palestinian issue, but believes it will not be resolved the way the United States and Israel have in mind, not by expanding illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land by consensus with others, that is. Resistance and referendum is the only viable solution to the Palestinian issue, according to Iran. That is to say, all original Palestinians of any faith displaced anywhere in the world must themselves decide their own fate by referendum. In Afghanistan, Iran seeks stability because with an insecure Afghanistan, the influx of refugees into Iran will increase. Also, drug trafficking towards this country will increase.
They came to Afghanistan 18 years ago, saying they wanted to uproot terrorism. But the result today is a tenfold, even 100-fold increase in drug production, growing insecurity in Afghanistan, migration of Afghans to Europe, Iran, and Pakistan. They said they wanted to remove Saddam because of chemical arms, which were never unearthed. Today, the Americans themselves, under the pretext of fighting Daesh, have triggered chaos in the entire region.
Iran believes intra-Afghan talks can lead to the process of establishing peace and stability with no need for third parties to interfere in the process. Abdul Ghafur Leval, the Afghan ambassador to Iran, expressed gratitude to this country for its support of the Afghan peace process, establishment of the legitimate government in that country, and hosting Afghan migrants for several decades. Iran's regional presence and intervention is understood, but one country raises eyebrows. I asked for justification to Iran's cooperation in Yemen.
As stated in its constitution, the Islamic Republic of Iran must defend the oppressed in the world. But this defense is legitimate, that is, at the request of those countries. The Yemenis also got help from us. We do not have a military presence in Yemen, but we have an advisory presence. We will help the Yemenis as much as we can and defend the rights of the Yemeni people in the international arena.
Iran calls for an end to Saudi and allied attacks on Yemen, and for Yemenis to decide their own destiny. In doing so, Iran submitted a 4-point Yemen peace plan to the United Nations.
The plan announced by Foreign Minister Zarif in 2015 calls for an immediate ceasefire and an end of all foreign military attacks, humanitarian assistance, and a resumption of broad national dialogue and establishment of an inclusive national unity government. The international community will no doubt have to get more effectively involved, as instability has been allowing terrorist groups to gain a foothold in Yemen. I asked, why does the U.S. pursue endless conflict everywhere, especially in West Asia?
Theorists have always said that seizing control of the Middle East is the necessary step towards world domination. One reason is the region's geographical situation that is located on the crossway of three continents. The second reason is the cultural situation. The region is where prophets had their revelations and heavenly books descended. The third and the most important reason is that 60% of the world's energy is supplied from this region. These unique characteristics have made this region a target for great world powers and colonialists from the United States to Britain and others.
To attempt the more everyday aspects of life and Iran's interest in its regional market. Iran's economy is based on industry and agriculture, and its service sector has been answering its domestic needs because of quality manpower. Now there's an overflow to be exported to regional states, but that requires stability and security in the neighborhood. The U.S. presence is a problem, as are its sanctions. It constantly imposes sanctions on Iran so that other states can't connect to Iranian goods and services. And then the U.S. imposes its own goods and services on those countries. So you can see, it's a constant chain of problems for this country.
If only insecurity would stop at harming the mutual benefits reaped from trade. Lives are being lost and countries are suffering upheaval. And so, Iran seeks U.S. withdrawal from the entire region because it agrees and believes that a U.S. presence will only increase insecurity and provoking public sentiment. It was in May 2020 that the Iranian President Rouhani pointed to problems faced by countries in the region, calling for their cooperation to overcome those problems, which have remained the coronavirus and falling oil prices, security problems, and most importantly, U.S. interference in these countries. His focus was on Iraq at the time. He expressed satisfaction that the political process in Iraq had reached a point when all Iraqi groups and tribes were alongside each other.
That's it for today. Thanks for watching from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. And don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام إذا دخل أحدكم على أخيه في رحلة فليقعد حيث يأمر صاحب الرحل، فإن صاحب الرحل أعرف بعورة بيته من الداخل عليه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "When someone enters the house of his fellow brother, he must sit wherever the host tells him to sit. For the owner of the house knows the flaws of his own house better than the guest."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, when talking about the famous dialogues and very beautiful conversations, we find an interesting conversation in the historical texts and the books of Hadith, the books of traditions, where we find that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam had a very interesting conversation with one of his most knowledgeable students by the name of Jabir al-Jufi. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam puts forth some very immortal commandments, which happen to be full of high moral standards and beautiful ideals through which a human being can become perfect if he puts them into effect. Now, one of the things that Imam al-Baqir said in this conversation with his most knowledgeable, or at least one of his most knowledgeable students, was that be careful not to trust the dishonest. A very beautiful statement that Imam al-Baqir put in this very long conversation with this very special student of his, Jabir al-Jufi, telling us to be careful not to trust the dishonest. It's interesting, sometimes we think that all people are honest. Unfortunately, dear listeners, we live in an era and we live in a world in the present day where that is not the case. Not everybody is trustworthy. And so, of course, if we are to trust somebody, or if we are to trust somebody with a trust, an amana, or with a secret, then we must be very careful that the person we are sharing these things, or giving these things, or trusting in general, is someone who is trustworthy. There are many people out there who will act like they are trustworthy, but deep down inside, they are dishonest. And of course, trusting someone who is dishonest will surely lead to harm, pain, and suffering. And so, very beautiful ideals and moral standards, which have been put forth in this conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Now, when we look at Imam alayhi salam, we understand the hadith of Jabir bin Abdullah al-Ansari, when the Holy Prophet said, "Ya Jabir, you will live longer, you will see him convey my salam." So Jabir bin Abdullah al-Ansari says, I was waiting for that moment. One narration says Jabir became blind. He couldn't see at the time when Imam al-Bakir was a young man. But he says, one day I was standing near a particular alleyway and I heard someone walking. The footsteps reminded me about the footsteps of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. So Jabir asked him, who are you? And he said, I'm Muhammad. Who is your father? He mentioned the name of Imam Sajjad. He continued until he mentioned that he was the grandson of Rasulullah. So the way the meeting went, Jabir hugged him and he was crying and he said, this is your salam from Rasulullah. He gave it to me. What we learn from here is that Jabir was blessed to see Rasulullah, to see Imam Amirul Mu'minin, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zainul Abidin, and then Imam Al-Bakir alayhi salam. As you can imagine, he was so blessed. But one important lesson we are learning from this particular anecdote is that when you are given salam, make sure you deliver it. Jabir was waiting to deliver that salam. How many times we travel, someone says, oh, okay, you are going to Mombasa, please say salam to them. Inshallah, I'll say salam. And you reach there, well, you forget all the salam. Jabir is telling us, no, you have to make sure. If you say, I will deliver the salam, make sure you deliver it. Because imagine Jabir, for how long he was waiting to meet with Imam al-Bakir alayhi salam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
In the limelight.
A majority of American voters surveyed in the wake of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol believe that twice impeached Donald Trump should be barred from ever running for office again, according to polling results reported exclusively by The Hill on Tuesday, January 19th. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, 57% of U.S. voters want Trump barred from seeking office ever again. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A majority of American voters surveyed in the wake of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol believe that twice impeached Donald Trump should be barred from ever running for office again. According to polling results reported exclusively by The Hill on Tuesday, January 19th, his last full day in office. The survey was conducted by the Center for American Political Studies at Harvard University and the Harris Poll from January 12th to 14th. It found that 57% of U.S. voters think Trump, who entered politics in 2015 to run for president, shouldn't be allowed to seek office in the future, compared with 43%